You've heard the story of John the Baptist's head being offered on a plate to Herod, the puppet ruler for Rome, whose mandate included Galilee. I like John. Although later editors of the New Testament try to gloss over it, it's probable he was Jesus' mentor. John knew fear, felt fear, probably compromised on incidentals, and yet did it and said it anyway. In the final analysis, John was killed because he peeved off the local potentate and his sycophants. I think most ideas that challenge the unjust foundations of church and state will face similar opposition, and those who articulate them run the risk of being served as a side dish at the banquet of power. Yet we need to call the political and spiritual Herods to account. By their actions or inactions, the good news of God in Jesus is not being realized. By their actions, though it's largely their inactions, injustice continues, poverty continues, exclusion continues. And they and we fail to place loving thy neighbor as our standard and goal. Let's be clear about that love of neighbor phrase that Jesus borrowed from the Hebrew scriptures. As you probably remember, he attached it to the story of the Good Samaritan. The point of that parable is that the one who is the neighbor is not the man in the ditch, but the Samaritan. It is the one who is the racial, cultural, and spiritual enemy. The one who threatens your faith, your understanding of the world, and the egotism that puts you at the center of the world. That's the one you are told to love. To love him or her is to give up your centrality. In order to make room for the threatening outsider and his or her ideas and whānau. To love thy neighbor is to feel the fear of difference, be open to it, and be changed. At General Synod Te Hino Tō Whānui in the last 9 days, as well as some moving speeches, not least from our Pacifica hosts, I have seen plenty of obfuscation and inaction, which would have fitted right in with the politics of Herod's court. Polynesia was magnificent in their hospitality, aroha, and grace. Yet those in control of the court were not Polynesia. Those in control, with the veneer of a bumbling niceness, allowed self-interest and defensiveness to dominate. In such a court context, the enemy was the inconvenient question, the so-called agitator, the media, the tweeter, and the Facebooker. It's hard to find one's way through the intricacies of this court to expose the inexplicit Herodian theology and practice without prematurely losing one's head. Let me give an example. There is widespread concern in church about the policies of the Key government, who in response to the recession, but probably planned anyway, have protected the income and benefits of the rich while cutting into the support and resources to the poor. However, this concern did not permeate through the intricacies of Herod's court in order to translate into specific actions of protest. Indeed, even the three social justice motions, none of which dealt with this fundamental disparity, were not discussed. We ran out of time. 8 days of long lunch breaks, half-hour morning and afternoon teas, socializing, etc., had more priority than the poor. Even at the 11th hour, when in a formal question, which means no debate, I gave the archbishops the wording to criticize the New Zealand government, which they then did, I was treated as a nuisance, a disruptor of smooth business. Then the court's news service didn't publicize the archbishop's criticism. Funny that. There were two motions discussed in relation to the ongoing church policies of excluding gays and lesbians from ordained ministry and the sacrament of marriage. What Herod's court is grappling with here are deep-seated institutional fears of change, of difference, of living in a pluralistic world, of disunity within the court, more concerned with conservatives and their money, conservatives who, of course, can get married and be ordained, than with the largely invisible exclusion of gays and lesbians. As an institution, this court is benignly and sometimes explicitly homophobic. Despite the grace and araha of many individuals and congregations within it, some of whom are evangelical. I offered in my speech that I believe was in the media here a 10-minute journey, courtesy of Professor Himori of Union Theological Seminary, into biblical material related to marriage and how it has changed in tandem with culture, particularly highlighting the days when marriage had to be within the family, when polygamy was normative, when the prohibition against mixed racial marriages was allowed, then prohibited, then allowed. The Jesus prohibition against divorce, and the stupidity of basing any sound theology on the de facto relationship between Adam and Eve. I think for many synod members, they'd never heard a biblical argument along these lines before. The general synod debate was quite moving. Most speakers from Polynesia and from Tikanga Māori spoke supportively. Only the more conservative Pākehā diocese spoke against my use of the Bible. How dare I use the court's handbook to argue for change? I was being disingenuous. They, of course, like many at court, hadn't done their homework and come prepared. Their sloppiness showed. The motion asked for discussion to take place right across the church and report back to the next General Synod in 2014. The second motion was about the freedom of a diocesan bishop to ordain whomever he or she chooses, albeit acting within the bounds of our canons or church law. Where the argument should take place is around what constitutes chastity, a requirement for priests. The canon says it's a right ordering of sexual relationships, thus begging the question of what is a right relationship. However, the debate didn't get into that. People still wanted to express their feelings and experiences, and the court's presidium wanted to close it down, put it safely in the "we will consider it later" basket, and go to morning tea. It was tabled, meaning there was no vote on it. So what was this excursion into a subject deeply affecting the LGBT community all about? Well, the debate signaled to the Conservatives that they've lost their majority hold on the Anglican Church, if they ever had it. But the Herods and their courtiers, wanting to be kind and pastoral and practical, don't want anyone or their money and congregations to leave. So defer, talk unity. And while all the time knowing that that stranglehold on marriage and that stranglehold on the mission to a priesthood is coming to an end. In the story of John the Baptist's beheading, there is the role of Salome, the dancer, and Herodotus, her mother. We need to read this text with what the scholars call a hermeneutic of suspicion. Both women were caught in the powerful web of the court and its subservience to its lord, Herod. My understanding of how the dynamics of such courts work is that what Herodias asked of Herod, what she believed and others in the court believed, he really wanted. When power relationships are strictly hierarchical, not mutual, the subservient wife becomes adept at only asking what she knows the all-powerful Lord will want to give. This, too, is how I suggest we should read the old story of the death of King David's son, Absalom, who was murdered by David's number one muscle man, Joab. Joab, of course, gets the blame, and David weeps long and loud. This is court BS. The subservient one is very careful to perceive his master's pleasure and do it. The religious scribes who later wrote up this account deliberately added to the PR spin on David, you know, that humble shepherd boy with the sling and sandals, and exonerated him of filicide, the murder of one's son. And I suspect the scribal community, always wanting to appease political masters, did the same centuries later with the beheading of the Baptist, wanting to blame the so-called wicked woman or women. Sound familiar? In state and church, it's not uncommon to see the principles of Herod's court at work. At General Synod, women rarely spoke and rarely chaired any of the proceedings. They were often absent from the negotiating groups dominated by the technocrat mind, trying to change wordings of bills and motions to encompass the span of differences and transform something that was pointed into an inoffensive compromise. Interestingly, at one stage, the court I've been part of was told an old story. The story goes that the Russian Orthodox Church was meeting when the Tsarist regime fell and the Bolshevik Revolution happened. The news was conveyed to the gathering. They chose to continue with their business for the next 4 days, deliberating on liturgy and liturgical vestments. I'd heard this story told before in the context of a salutary reminder of our need to engage with the world rather than hide in the rarefied environment of our ecclesiastical world. However, this time, our court was told it in a manner not disparaging of the Russian Church, but joked how they had outlasted the Bolsheviks. I felt like vomiting at that point. The court of now and of long ago have an institutional aversion to prophets and their ideas. Prophets disrupt a business. They question the preset agenda. They question who has power and why. They don't do fear. They say it how they see it. They tell anyone who will listen how the Lord Emperor is dressed without getting the Emperor's permission to say it. And the Lord Emperors are not amused, indeed privately are very angry. But it is often their loyal followers, like Herodias or Joab, who act on that anger, seeking to serve up the critic on a dish to their master. Modern-day prophets and prophecy, and those of us who try to walk, albeit stumblingly, that path, call the court, whether it be church or state, to adhere to a standard, a plumb line, as Amos might say, accountable to the ministry and mission of Jesus and his mentor, John the Baptist. Prophets say it loud, say it long, and they are not liked. On Friday, I symbolically tried to shake the court's dust off my soul as I landed in Auckland, drove to St. Matthew's, kissed the pavement, and gave thanks for this wonderful cosmopolitan city of ours that at its heart doesn't do fear.